some of this advice is going to shrink years and years off of just being out in the real world and practicing this stuff if you're aware of it through reading some of these interviews and some of the experiences of these guys. It can accelerate your learning curve dramatically.
This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. I want to thank you guys week after week for coming back and listening to these podcasts. I know that you must enjoy them or you don't keep coming back. I try to give you something a little bit different all the time and something that will help you learn and grow as a magician and as a human being. This week is something quite different that I think you will learn from as well, and that is a book, actually. This is not so much of a book review as it is a chat with the authors. There are two authors of this book. The book is entitled A Magician Prepares. It's a book that has 19 different magicians who were interviewed by these two guys, Joshua Stenkamp and Jason Wethington. And the two gentlemen had actually physically gone to talk with each of these magicians and ask them a series of questions. A lot of times they were the same questions, but you get different perspectives, obviously, because everyone is a little bit different and has a different answer to those same questions. But they're not put in the same way. This is an interesting book. One of the reasons I wanted to do this is certainly there are new magic books and other books coming out all the time. But I thought this had a little bit different twist because, like my podcast, where I'm talking with people and kind of get extemporaneous types of answers, and sometimes there are candid conversations, and you feel like you're a fly on the wall, just kind of eavesdropping on our conversations, which is exactly what I intend for these podcasts to be. In a way, this is similar to that. In other words, it's kind of like reading a podcast. It's a transcript of a podcast, and indeed, actually, what they did was to take a microphone in when they chatted with these other magicians and asking them the questions, and they just recorded it, and then they transcribed it. But also, getting into the conversation, they talk a little bit about what's happening, where they are and what they're doing and the circumstances leading up to going to that person's home or backstage or wherever it happened to be to chat with the person. And then the interview kind of looks like kind of like a Playboy type of a Magic magazine where they've had an interview with somebody where it would say, okay, this is us asking, and then they would have the name of the person, then they would answer the questions. And so it's, and then at the end, it's kind of wraps up and said, okay, now we're finished and we're moving on, getting back in our Uber or whatever, and heading back to the hotel or whatever. So you kind of get a feel as if it's, again, you are reading what you would have heard had they actually put this onto a podcast. They decided to put this into a book form rather than onto a podcast. Well, they'll get into that. I don't want to spoil too much of this. But before they actually get into talking about this book, I talked quite a bit with Jason about his work with Kostya Kimlet and Restaurant Magic Business. You might recall that many years ago, back in 2011, when I first started with this podcast, I had talked with Kostya Kimlet, and I was involved with the Restaurant Magic Business. Well, here we are now 6 years later, and it's kind of interesting to hear a perspective of not necessarily what went wrong, but what went right with the Restaurant Magic Business, where it stands today, and the model that he had used. And anyhow, I think it's kind of an interesting perspective to see kind of this arc of what's been happening over the last several years. It's also interesting that Jason had moved from Orlando to Portland, Oregon. So we talk a little bit about the difference also, one place being a popular tourist attraction, another one being a little bit different in that it is not necessarily high on the list of places for tourists to go, as it would be to Universal Studios or to Disney World. So anyhow, a lot of interesting things I think that you will enjoy hearing about this book. And the book is available from these guys directly that you can go to amagicianprepares.com, or you can get it through Amazon. And if you're going to be getting it through Amazon, of course, I'd suggest that you would go through the link on the Magic Word Podcast. Go to themagicwordpodcast.com, find the link there on our Amazon affiliate store, click on that. That will take you to Amazon where you can then order. And that way that we have a relationship with Amazon, so this way that they help contribute a small portion of any of your purchases to us. So that's a way of helping to donate to us. Well, enough of that for right now. These guys have a lot to say, and it's a very interesting conversation, and they talk, well, let me introduce you this week to our guest. Please welcome Joshua Stenkamp and Jason Wethington here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for TheMagicWordPodcast.com, and it gives me great pleasure to talk with a couple of guys who have just finished a book, and we're going to get into that and much more here shortly. But I've got Joshua Stenkamp. Hello there, Joshua.
Howdy, howdy.
And also my friend from for years back, Jason Wethington, down in Florida. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having us.
I'm glad that you're here, and I appreciate you, you know, reaching out and wanting to talk about this, because it sounds like kind of an interesting project. And I want to get to that for just a second, but, you know, Jason, we haven't talked for a little while, and I wanted to kind of get a follow-up, because it's kind of funny that this podcast itself goes back, I think, to like 2011, when one of the first ones I was recording back then and posting was from Kosta Kimlet's Restaurant Magic Business. What's a follow-up? What's been going on with that? Is that kind of had the full circle, or is it still going on, or what's happening? Or happened?
Yeah, you know, Restaurant Magic Business, it was an interesting endeavor. It turned out that it wasn't the right offering. It wasn't the right service for the marketplace. So I think after a few years, Kostya ended up kind of pulling away from that somewhat, giving it to the local markets and the magicians that we had talked to and were setting up in the different cities. And just basically giving the idea and everything that we had learned from the process of setting it up to them and let them run with it. So, and I think he's now focusing, he's down in, still in Orlando, focusing on the business magician and his team of guys down there. So, yeah, so that's kind of what happened with that. I moved away from it. Maybe a year after, I guess, that we had all seen each other at the conferences and stuff like that, Scott. And, yeah, just been bouncing around the last few years. I'm an entrepreneur now. I have a few businesses that I run. And, yeah, I'm doing a magic, kind of a magic pop-up here in Portland now. So,
well, that's what I was about to ask. So I assume you're no longer in Orlando. When you say Portland, wow, that's from one end to the other, quite literally.
Yeah. After Josh and I finished up working on the book, my business partner, Blake, who's another magician, he's out here in Portland and wanted to get some things going. So he called me up, and we just started we have an artist collective where we're bringing in artists from all different genres to help us create a larger, more beautiful pieces of art for the city of Portland. We have a pop-up experience that's called Life, where we're combining music, food, art, and magic into an immersive experience that explores the journey of life through all of those different ways of telling the story. So some exciting things on the horizon and in the works out here in Portland.
Well, I would think that Portland, from what I've heard, would be completely the antithesis of Orlando and the big tourist spot that that is. Because I always think of, well, of course, the popular television show of Portlandia that we see here in the U.S. Now that depicts Portland as being kind of like the land of crazy things going on,
weird stuff. Yeah, in Portland, it's kind of funny. Portlandia is more of a documentary than it is a parody. It's it really is indicative of what this city is. It's just a beautiful city that really embraces people that want to express their individuality. Right. And they understand that through that, they create a more interesting community. So, yeah, it's a really cool place to be.
So basically,
beautiful,
like,
absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, basically that the hippie communes of the 60s have decided to move to this city and broaden their awareness, I guess, there.
And Portland's kind of suffering an interesting some issues right now with their personality, with things going on in you know, the political climate in the U.S. and Portland being a very progressive city. It's becoming gentrified here, so a lot of the stuff that is quote unquote Portland. Portlanders feel like it's being pushed out of the city because of the gentrification and things like that. So one of the things that we're doing with the artists here is just trying to invigorate and revitalize some of that artistic expression and bring that to the city.
And when you're saying artists, you're not just referring to physical art, but also, I guess, performing arts, like magic and dance and theater and that kind of a thing as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're collaborating with a lot of different types of artists. We've got YouTubers, photographers, videographers, graphic artists, musicians. We're collaborating magicians. We're collaborating with a whole bunch of different artists to create these different pieces. So
what's the magic vibe like up there as far as the community? Do they have a lot of magicians that are performing?
It doesn't seem like there's a very vibrant magic community here in Portland. There is some small groups around. I haven't really connected with many of them yet. There's not a large presence here in Portland. I think Vancouver, Washington has the closest brick and mortar store. I could be wrong about that, but I think that's the closest brick and mortar shop.
Yeah, I remember there was one up there. I thought that Murray Hatfield had one, and it may have been in Vancouver, but his closed quite a couple of years ago, I believe, quite some time ago.
Okay.
But I don't know if that was the one in Vancouver or somewhere else. So, yeah, I'm sure someone who will be listening to this will post a comment.
Yeah, there was a Portland, I want to say it's called the Portland Magic Jam, that happened a couple of weeks ago. We were just at the Penguin Magic Expo talking about the book, and that was a decent turnout there. And I think maybe a week before or 2 weeks before, there was another magic convention in town. So they seem to have, there's a lot of magicians. It didn't seem like a whole lot of performers, but that could just be also that I've only lived here for, I think, going on 3 months now, so not very long.
Well, no, you got a point. I just remember the Portland Magic Jam. I remember seeing that on Facebook. It seems like, I want to say Michael Finney and a few other. I mean, it sounded like a pretty good roster of magicians.
They had Ossie and Banachek. Yeah, they had some really good names.
Yeah, that they had brought in. So, and that was something that was actually for the public and not like a magic convention. Is that right?
I think he has aspects of it that are like a normal magic convention where you've got lectures, you've got shows, and then there are public performances associated with it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah. Going back for just a second on the restaurant magic business, and I know that Kosha had a lot of great ideas, and it just seemed like that what I loved about the concept was that he was so committed behind it that it was going to make it a go one way or the other. And different times when you think it was dead, that he was still revitalizing that. I mean, I've never seen anybody with more energy than him,
It was, it is a good idea. The thing that was the killer for us was scalability of the concept.
Right. It worked in Orlando, but couldn't go much further out of the city, it seemed.
Yeah, you really need what we found, at least in my business, is when you're starting something like Restaurant Magic Business, and it's a philosophy that's actually mimicked in the Art of War, right? Where you want every individual within the organization to understand the vision that you're trying to accomplish so clearly that everyone in the organization takes ownership of it. And through that, we're able to create the overall larger vision. And without us being in each city,
right,
sort of helping things along in the beginning, we grew too big too fast is really what happened. I think it's a good idea, and I think that the model is proven out, again in Orlando, and maybe it is because it's a tourist city and it has that draw to it. But Kostya's been working with a local community of business owners, and his clients are, he's got an international client base, obviously, but his core group of clients are there locally. And, I think it is a good model. Like I said, we just grew too big too fast.
Yeah.
And that happens sometimes. And those are the best lessons to learn. Not every business is going to be a success. Not every business is going to work.
Right.
From a financial standpoint. But when you look at a business as an experiment and as just something that you're trying to do and working towards building, Restaurant Magic Business was an absolute success. We all learned so much. In fact, a lot of the lessons that I learned there I've been able to apply to my own consulting work when I'm helping other businesses and brands with what they're doing, and in our own business as we're trying to scale and put different processes and things in place. So it was a really amazing experience.
Well, I can appreciate that, certainly. And he had a good model. And as you said, maybe there was trying to be too large, too fast, but the idea of trying to have people who would be from or rather businesses, I guess, that were franchised across the country. So this way that once that you got in with the franchise, then obviously they'd want to hire magicians for each of those all throughout, which is a great idea. But in practice, it was a very hard sell. And although he did try to sell that, and he had traveled to Houston, and then he went with me around to some of the clients, and I know he did to some of the other cities, maybe Atlanta and elsewhere. I think that the idea was that it was so successful, perhaps in Orlando, that instead of branching out just into the Florida statewide area, that he was thinking globally. Yeah. You know, he's a big picture thinker. You know, one thing that I took away from Kostya that I still think about at least once a week or more often maybe than that, and whenever you're flying into a city, particularly flying into Houston, and I look at these large buildings, and as he was saying, I love coming into Orlando because as I'm landing, I'm looking at each of those buildings and thinking in each one of those windows that they represent a business, and that's a potential opportunity. That's somebody I need to go and talk to because they've got some function sometime this year that they're going to need a magician and I'm the right guy for them. So there are unlimited opportunities. And so he was saying that I'm not giving up a piece of the pie. I'm just making the pie larger for everybody to have an equal piece, basically. So it was a different way of looking at things. I just loved his perspective.
Yeah. You know, we for a long time, Kostya and I go way, way back, and we've always talked about the concept that there's no competition, and especially in magic and really in the entertainment field, having pulled out of magic and being able to move into different other industries and especially creative industries, you see that there's a lot of similarities and personalities with creatives, regardless of how they choose to express themselves, whether it's through dance or acting or magic or however they choose. There is this feeling of, everybody wants to try to get the gig, and if they don't get the gig, they feel like they're losing the gig. They feel like they're in competition with everybody else who's doing the same thing that they are. And the reality is that they're not. The reality is that we're all unique in our own expressions. And, you know, these companies, they don't hire us. They're hiring us as magicians because they want magic, but they're not really hiring magic tricks. The magic tricks are kind of meaningless. It's the magician who's magic and the magician who's valuable. And when you come from that understanding, like Kostya says, when you see those windows and you see people as opportunities that can help you, towards your goal. So, yeah, absolutely. Kostya's one of my favorite human beings on this planet. He is just an absolutely beautiful human being.
Well, I agree with you on that 100%. It seems also, Jason, that there are so many magicians who are really good at what they do and create and perform, however, that they don't know the other side, and that is the business side of the show. So it's that other two-thirds that gives them difficulty, and that there aren't any real agents out there or business managers who work with magicians, or magicians don't seek them out. Yeah. They think that we think we can do it all ourselves, obviously, and as a result, fail a lot of times in trying to follow through. Like you're writing a letter and putting a stamp on it, but never getting around to dropping it in the post office. I mean, everybody's got the idea, but you just don't have the follow through to it. I mean, there are many magicians I know like that who could and should be much more successful and much more well known in the international community, but it's just they don't know how to go about putting together a business plan and following that through. That's why you got another point, I think, it had to do with as far as understanding what the businesses are looking for. They're not looking necessarily, sure, they want to add some magic, but it's the personality. When they look out at the vast array of magicians on the internet, when they start searching for them, trying to find that one personality that clicks with their vision, that's why I think trade show magicians in general are more successful business-wise, because first of all, they understand business, and number two, they know that, or we know that we are going to be selling the company first, and magic is just a vehicle to sell that product.
Yeah, I've always felt that about trade shows, that it was a more direct link to what a common understanding of what marketing is as a form of expression, right? The magician is there as like a living breathing marketing experience for a company. Yeah, and you know, it's funny when you were mentioning before about, you know, magicians, we can't do it all. That's one of the biggest things that we see in entrepreneurs in general. It's their greatest strength and also their greatest weaknesses. And magicians are right in that group where it's the strength of recognizing yourself as an individual and recognizing that this is something that you want to go out and do for your life. Like, it's not just a hobby. If you want to go out there and you want to make a living doing it. You get out there on your own, and then you realize that you don't just have to do magic. You have to be a marketer. You have to be your operations. You have to be your financial person. You have to be all of these things. And that's also our greatest weakness, because we can't be all of those things. Our strengths are really, you know, everyone has different strengths, but the strength is being creative and being out there and creating these magic experiences. And if you can find people that are better at those other things than you, you will be wildly more successful, and the other person will be wildly more successful by working together.
Right. No, I agree with you. Yeah, again, 100%. That's true, yeah. Certainly. I've heard somebody say that although it's a big expense, if you were to put in tens of thousands of dollars annually, just 1 year even, into a PR firm, a company that would actually promote you, instead of trying to find an agent, you buy an agent. You buy someone who basically puts you in all of these venues because they give you a higher level of noticeability, I guess, and you will be more successful. First of all, you have to have an act before you do anything. But that leads back also to something you said there, Jason, as far as many years ago, I remember hearing Mark Kalin, when he was working in Reno, we were talking about, he puts this, used to put this newspaper in the local casinos and hotels. And there were free newspapers, and they had ads for different places, restaurants around town to see, and coupons, and a couple of news stories that were not necessarily topical nor even newsworthy, but for the most part, it talked a lot about his show and had pictures from the show, et cetera, et cetera. But it looked like a newspaper, and because that it had advertising in it, that people would take that, saying, oh, it must be a good place to go over here. Well, that was not a weekly newspaper nor monthly. That was just one time type of a thing that he underwrote by having the advertisers to actually pay for all that. And then he talked with the hotels to be able to put that newspaper in there. And so people, the tourists who are coming in, are always picking up the same newspaper and, you know, trying his restaurants, et cetera. But it was also selling his show. But the point of all of this was that he said, although I'm good at this, this, and this, you know, and choreographing a show and creating that and putting together the magic kits that we'll sell or whatever, and, you know, leasing the building and doing the advertising and the promotion, et cetera, at some point they just kind of had to say, you know, that it's guns or butter, simply a matter of economics. You can do kind of one or the other. You really can't successfully do all of them. So therefore, I'm going to have some ad agency handle this. I'll have somebody else do my web page. You know, even though I can design my own, I'll do this. I'll farm it out, basically. It's just that we're – a lot of times magicians are hesitant to let go of things. We want to keep control of everything, but you need to let some of this go and also to pay somebody else for their expertise, because as good as you might think that you are on a particular thing, the best thing we should be good at is doing magic and creating, and let someone else sell us, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's always best having an outside perspective come in and look at you and help you communicate yourself to other people. Sometimes we're not the best at doing it ourselves. You know, one of the tenets of our business here in Portland is that all business really gets boiled down to a successful conversation between two people. And if you can understand how to do that, then you can understand how to build those conversations so that you can have tens of thousands of them, you can have millions of them, but it really hinges on being able to have one successful conversation and then continuing to build and refine and get clearer and clearer on what it is that you're trying to do, trying to accomplish, and really what value you're trying to bring to the world. You know, that's really at the bottom of, you know, for magicians to really understand what it is that they're bringing into the world, that they're creating experiences that people want to take back, these stories that they want to take back to their communities and tell their friends, you know, be the experience in their group of friends. So, Yeah, getting clear on the message is super important.
That's very deep and very heavy for a lot of magicians who are just the weekend warriors or doing birthday parties and not doing this as a full-time profession. And that's well and good, too. It's just I think you need to know where you are and where you want to be. It's all part of goals you have and life plans.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we work with a lot of really interesting people, creative directors, and that is always, it always comes down to that. Even if it's even the weekend warriors, if you understand like what it is that you're trying to create for the people that you're going out and performing for, and it's not just a magic show. Magicians, we do tend to kind of focus in because that's what we do. Like an artist will focus on a painting. Magicians focus on the magic trick or the magic show, and there's a much bigger experience that we're creating in the world that sometimes if you have a moment to be able to, if you're not working in your business and having to do all of those things and you can pull yourself out to look at your business or what it is that you're trying to do as a whole, it can really give you a much better and much broader perspective. And you can see some of those opportunities like what Mark Kalin was doing with the advertising those newspapers, being able to find those opportunities in your community to help bring more of what you want to do to it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And again, I think that boils down to what do you want to do with your magic? I mean, as people are performing,
absolutely.
A lot of people who are listening to this have, well, everybody has a little bit different perspective of what they may just want to entertain their grandkids or that they want to entertain their salesman, want to do a trick for their client or something. At the other end of the spectrum, there are people who are doing everything, you know, on a full-time basis. And so I just think that as long as you know where you are in the scheme of things and where you want to be, I've said this years ago, going back to restaurants again, if you're working in a restaurant, is that the, and then at 20 years from now, you look back and you're still in the same restaurant and you're saying, well, gee, why didn't this catapult me into whatever else? Well, that may not have been part of your goal. And if it was, then either that was not the right venue or there should have been something else that you should have been doing in order to try to access that and unlock that larger goal, I guess, you know. And so not that that's a bad thing. It's just that as long as that 20 years from now, you know that, hey, this is where I am and I'm fine with this because I'm still having a good time. On the other hand, I remember, for an example, Charles Green III was using restaurants as a kind of a launch pad for him to get into doing trade shows. And he was working like 9 restaurants in a week. And as a result, had moved then into doing trade shows, moved out to Washington, D.C. area and very successful as a trade show guy. But he knew what he wanted to do. And he had a goal that within a certain number of years, I'm going to start to do this many shows and then this many shows and then put this all behind me. So and that was his goal. But I'm just saying, you just need to know where you want to be, you know.
Absolutely. It's so key. It really is. And like you said, you know, with restaurants, like if that is your goal and you just want to be the best restaurant performer that you can be, that's a solid goal.
Absolutely.
That's a really valuable thing. Other people, you know, like myself, I always had, you know, wherever I was at, I was always looking at it as a learning opportunity to bring me to the next place, to bring me to the next level of what it was that I was trying to accomplish. And that there was never, in my life, there's never been like an end goal. It's always been, you know, Ali Bongo years ago at a IBM SAM convention in Cincinnati told me, he's like, in entertainment, when anyone comes up to you and offers you an opportunity, say yes, and then figure out how to do it later. I always approached things with that. I thought that was genius. He had obviously was very successful, and I thought that was just brilliant advice. And I think I was, you know, in my early 20s at the time, and I just said that sounds fantastic. And
I heard that story similarly told about Doug Henning in the early years. Matter of fact, his first television commercial in which that he had been doing the magic show on Broadway and all that. He had great success. And so Exxon had approached him and said that we are interested in having this television show. But people worldwide or nationwide don't necessarily know who Doug Henning is, even though he's successful in this magic show on Broadway. But we would like to bring back Houdini's Water Torture. And can you do that? And he said, Yes, of course. And they said, okay, well, then we will book you and we'll do the show. And they started making all the plan. He walked out of the room, and I understand the first call he made then was, I think, to John Gaughan, or, you know, and said, hey, do you know how to build one of these? I have no idea, you know, how to do it and what's the trick. You know, I understand the trick, but can you build one and can we do this? And so yes was the answer, and then figure it out later, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Magicians are great at being able to do that. Like, we need the puzzle first. Like, sometimes having the idea is great, but getting the puzzle presented to you and then going, okay, let's do this and let's figure it out, it's such a blast.
Well, I think that's – you got a good point there, that is a lot of what magicians enjoy are puzzles. And that's – unfortunately, sometimes illusions, and I mean close-up and stage illusions, are presented as puzzles. To me, that I think challenges the intelligence of the audience, which is fine too, because they're trying to figure out, huh, where did she go? You know, the girl must have gone someplace. For an example, there's the one illusion, I think, in a cube zag in which that the person is in there and sliced and diced, and then the hand sticks out. It's like, wait a minute. I thought she had disappeared, you know, so now she is somehow or another, you know, a contortionist inside there. So now it becomes a puzzle for them to figure out how is she contorted in that box to make that work, as opposed to letting her mind kind of, I mean, they know that she's not gone, but just for a moment, they might think she's gone, but suddenly the hand's back, then it becomes a puzzle. I'm just using that as an example, you know.
For sure.
I think that you're right. The magicians are interested in puzzles, which is why that we are enamored by Sherlock Holmes. It's that deductive reasoning. It's like, you know, what can you, you know, how can you figure out this larger puzzle of life kind of thing?
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit, and Josh could probably chime in here too. When we met,
Josh, you're going to jump in here anytime because I feel so bad. Talk for half hour and have it review.
No, it's all right. I'm enjoying listening to it.
We were talking to Dan Sylvester when we were interviewing him for the book, and he was explaining his first magical experience. And for people who don't know who Dan Sylvester is, he has a character, Sylvester the Jester, which is a living cartoon. It's one of the most imaginative and just brilliant
sound effects.
And self-built. Like, he builds everything. He is a genius. And his first experience with magic, he didn't grow up around magicians. He grew up in a small, I think it was Youngstown or near Youngstown. I could be wrong on that. I could be completely missing his hometown up there. Yeah. But it was in Ohio, and he had had an experience. He was taking a shower, and he looked at the wall in his bathroom, and there was a crack in the tile. And his father, he was explaining about his father would get very upset at things like that. And Dan, I think he was in high school at the time, or maybe a little bit younger. And, you know, his mind starts running like, oh my God, my dad is going to be so upset that the tile is cracked. How did this happen? He reached over to touch, to feel the crack, and the crack moved as he touched it. It just transformed. And he realized it was a hair. And in his mind, there was this shift where he realized his mind was creating a reality in front of him, and that he was able to, if I can show this to another person and get their mind to create the same reality, that same false reality, then I can show them a magic trick too. And that's what spurred his mind into the puzzle. Whereas, like, a lot of times magicians come at it from the puzzle first. We get enamored by the methods and the intricate workings. And Dan's mind came at it from, he saw magic first and then figured out on the back end that there was a method to it, which I think is an interesting way of seeing magic.
That's a different perspective, certainly, yeah. So the title of the book, again, The Magician Prepares, is kind of what this is about. And the reason I was interested in talking with you guys is because that, just like what I do on the podcast, is talk to a lot of magicians about their ideas and how they prepare, basically, and what is their creative muse, et cetera. And so you've gone out and talked to like 19 different magicians and put this into a book.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a podcast in a book, in the written form, in a way.
Basically, yeah. So it was an interesting journey, because Jason, you know, was living down here in Florida, and we were kind of talking, and it was this concept of, they were podcasts, but I really wanted to talk about character development and how magicians created their characters, because I did a lot of theater, and getting them to talk about it, because it was always, when you would read a book, it would always be one person's point of view, and I wanted we wanted an idea of having multiple points of view with kind of the same question lines and seeing how they answer them and how they coincide with each other. And it was really interesting to see the development, and we got a lot more than just character development. So it was very interesting to sit down with all of these magicians. It was very, very pleasing.
Yeah.
What was one of the most enlightening things that you found, what you heard, or one of the stories from the guys?
Danny Sylvester's was great. Everyone had a great story. I mean, one of my favorites is probably Todd Robbins, when we sat down with him and him talking about kind of pushing boundaries in a show and how you sometimes cannot recover from it. Because Todd Robbins was talking about Play Dead that he did with Teller.
Right.
And they brought up a person in the show, and they're going to reveal a name, and they revealed the name, and it was the man's mother who had passed away, I don't know, like 10 years ago, and the man just broke down on stage, and there was no really recovering from that. Like, Todd picked the guy up and, you know, apologized and explained to him, and I guess the guy, like, his mother had passed away, and he wasn't there. All hit him at once, you know, hundreds of people. And so Todd really went into talking about, like, sometimes you just can't recover from those things, but you have to keep moving on because, you know, Jay was just saying, like, if you finish it, sometimes that's not the best idea. So it was an interesting story that things can go wrong and it's okay to stop and just take a minute to make sure that you're not pushing those boundaries too hard.
Well, yeah. And, you know, magic is an extremely powerful expression of art, and it can affect people very deeply. It can be a life-changing experience for them. And I think Todd was sort of illuminating how powerful when you frame, and even when you're trying to be careful about framing something as this is just an effect, it can still have a very powerful. Magic has a wonderful way of bringing people into a moment, bringing them into this, you know, a moment of awareness of themselves, of the world around them, and it shifts the way that they see things. And yeah, sometimes, like, it's not always the best to, like, ask for applause at the end and, you know, let's have this, you know, send this person back to their seat for a round of applause. Sometimes the best thing is to pick them up, give them a hug, and tell them that, you know, you're sorry, and your hope that they're going to be okay, basically.
Right, right.
It's it can be a very powerful thing, yeah.
I remember that Jamie Salinas and I, doing seances here, had learned early on some years ago that we were not trying to draw up images or memories, I should say, of loved ones, because it would be too emotional for them to try to speak to them through the false seance, you know, the trickery we were doing, basically. And so when we were doing, for example, a living and dead test, that he was always very conscientious in saying, I want you to think then of someone who you knew, but in a memory of them is not going to cause you such emotional trauma, but basically someone who you knew and respected, and, you know, you just have pleasant memories of them, basically. So in other words, that it was, yeah, it won't be a happy thing necessarily, but at least you have good memories. And whenever you start thinking of a very close loved one, and then whenever that person is revealed in this living and dead test, you know, then if that's the case, then they could break down. You don't want that to happen. So that's why we learned early on to make sure when you're talking about something like that, you know, and the same thing, I'm sure Todd had learned some things then as well. So in the book that's called, yeah, Magician Prepares, what is it that brought you to come to that title as far as Prepares?
It was because I went to school for theater. There's a very famous book called An Actor Prepares, and it's written by Stanislavski, which is, sure, a lot of people consider the father of acting character, right, development. So it was kind of an homage to him, because I was thinking, you know, what was so revolutionary for theater, what could be something that's a little different for magic? And so we chose A Magician Prepares. And it also is because we talk about their life and how they got to where they're at and the advice that they have learned throughout the years. So it was kind of, we kind of took it from Stanislavski's book to kind of make it more theater oriented.
And when you were recording this, were these actual recordings that you transcribed then, or was it just through some questions and answers that they responded by email and then you copied that, or what?
No, I traveled the U.S. I made sure that we tried to do every interview in person, and yeah, we recorded them all. You know, at the time, it was a strong learning curve because I didn't really know how to do a podcast or interview anyone. So I had my phone, and I did all the recordings basically on my phone, and then yeah, we had them transcribed. And some people would say, "Hey, do you mind cutting that out of the audio? I don't want that to be in the book." So yeah, it was it took about a year and 10 months. I mean, if we ever did this again, it would come out a lot sooner because now we know what we're doing. But yeah, the only person we actually did like Skype call with was Peter Samuelson, and that was because we just kept missing each other every single time. But everybody else we actually sat down in person to talk.
Was there anybody who actually refused or said no? I'd really rather not.
Everyone was really kind about it. We had a few people that said, you know, Todd was very nice enough to let me reach out to Teller to try to get him part of the book, and he was very kind, and he messaged us, and because we self-published, I think it was like his agent or manager wasn't quite sure about it, so we didn't quite get him. But anyone that we asked that said no, they were never rude or anything like that.
Sure.
It was very no, but I like the project, and I'll support you in any way.
I remember some years ago, someone had approached me and asked if I would help them in publishing a book basically on errors or problems or fumbles or foibles, whatever problem I'd have, bloopers basically, magician bloopers. And I said, you know, I was too busy with other projects. I said, I'm really not interested. Well, anyhow, the book eventually got published, but I always felt as if that in that particular case, that magicians would hold back. In other words, that if there was an embarrassing moment that happened in their show, you wouldn't want the whole world to know about that forever and have it in print. That would live in perpetuity, whereas that they might say, okay, well, here's a little funny thing that happened, but not be the worst thing that ever really happened. So, you know, I always felt like that, well, they're going to hold back. You know, it's kind of like a recipe book from a great chef that's not going to give you that one ingredient that you really need to make that taste exactly like they do at the restaurant, kind of a thing. But did you feel as if that in this case that everybody pretty much gave you everything? Because here they weren't really exposing secrets of their
lives.
There
were a few people that kind of held back.
Yeah.
Because Jay would ask the question about like the happy accidents, and I mean, we had a few people that talked about some bad things that happened on stage, but I'll let Jay kind of explain that.
Yeah, you know, performing, I was at Walt Disney World, you know, for a little over a decade performing, and I shouldn't say anything that could have gone wrong, but most things that could have gone wrong within a performance, within any particular performance piece, pretty much did go wrong. I mean, I performed literally tens of thousands of shows at Walt Disney World. So lots of things, can go wrong in a show, and just being aware. So I would always ask how, you know, I knew that I wasn't alone. I knew that I wasn't the only guy who would stand up on stage and sometimes be in the middle of routine. And, you know, you're thinking about what you want for dinner later on, and you lose your, you kind of snap back into reality, and you're like, you realize you're on stage in front of 500 people, and I have no idea what the joke I just said was, I don't remember what the move I just did was, and you find yourself in these moments. Or, you know, I've had moments where I pick up a prop and it literally just fell apart in my hands, in my case, not realizing that it was, you know, time for it to be put back together. And so what do you do? How do you handle moments where you're on stage and something goes sideways? And it's the old tenet of magic of not telling an audience what you're going to do before you do it. In practical application, that's what we were really going so that the audience doesn't really know, so that when something does go sideways, that you can either A, cover it, or sometimes, like with Todd, sometimes it's just not salvageable, and the best thing to do is just move on. And even if you don't know exactly how you're going to get out of it, know that it's probably going to go wrong at some point, and you might need to. So,
yeah. It's just like owning a computer. You know that eventually your hard drive is going to crash. You just don't know when.
It was really fascinating. I think one of the most interesting things about the whole process of the book, and you know, Josh and I would talk about this, the differences in performing style. You could take Dan Sylvester, Tom Frank, Jeff Allen, who's a local performer in Orlando, who's absolutely genius, Peter Samuelson, really like the cross-section, Rudy Kobe, any of the guys that or, you know, women, Tina Leonard. There was a similar approach to being a magician and what they were trying to communicate. It was like, you know, the differences were small, really. Differences in, you know, the approach to character, what the actual character was that they were trying to present. Mm-hmm. But there was this underlying deep love for trying to create a sense of wonder and bringing imagination to life in their audiences. So,
but there again,
yeah, it was really cool. Just as,
it goes back, as the title implies, the magician prepares. In other words, they have prepared to themselves for that show because they have a character. And a lot of times the magician, a lot of magicians are still trying to find who we are on stage. And are we an extension of ourselves? Or are we a particular different character? But you need to know who you are and what you are. It's just like, and I remember Bob Cassidy used to talk to me about in mentalism, to know what your powers are. I mean, don't go out and do everything. You need to know what it is you do. And the same thing as a character, like you were saying, that each of those people you talk with, I'm sure, have developed a character, and that's what they're trying to do and be on stage.
Interesting. Oh, sorry, Josh. I was just going to say, some of them were even working. They had created a character, and through the exploration of that character on stage, they were moving past, or the way that I like to visualize it is moving through that character and becoming more of themselves on stage and bringing that to their audiences, becoming more real and more authentic in what they were bringing to the stage. But was one of the interesting questions that Josh would always ask about their character and how they would get into character.
Yeah, and to talk about, Jay, what you just said about, like, people creating a character and then finding their actual character or themselves on stage. Like, Tony Brandt was a great person that we interviewed, who's here in Orlando. And he does – I mean, he would do – how many characters do you think he did, Jay? 10 on stage?
At least.
Wow.
At least.
And, yeah, and now I would ask him, like, do you still do the characters? And he would talk about, no, I've weeded out a few. I still maybe – he maybe only does about 3 characters on stage, and – now he knows his character as himself, so it's mostly just Tony Brandt on there, kind of the hippie guitarist. And it took him, you know, years to be able to find that. So it was kind of interesting, the journey that they went through. And also, in the reason that the book is called The Magician Prepares is I found it, again, that whole, like, it's only, you read a book, it's one person's point of view. Having 19 different magicians is, if you don't agree with one of the magicians, you're going to agree with something that another magician said. So you have a vast encyclopedia of information that you can agree with, because sometimes you'll pick up a book, and I've done that in magic books where I go, I really don't agree with what he was saying. This doesn't really speak to me.
Right.
But in our interviews, one person may not speak to you, but another person will. So it kind of gives you like a vast knowledge base.
Yeah, I always think of it that great quote about good artists borrow, great artists steal. And, you know, looking at your art, one of the things, Jeff Allen, again, I just loved his interview. He's just such a brilliant guy, and not many people know who he is, but he really is a brilliant and very deep thinker. He would talk about I just lost my train of thought. What were you just saying, Josh? It's early here in Portland.
as far as getting multiple points of view, I think is what I said, right?
Getting multiple points of view and seeing, getting as broad of a perspective of what you're doing and being able to bring that into your performance and trying all these different ways of expressing it, stealing from each of these interviews. Like Josh was saying, you're not going to agree with everyone, but everyone has a nugget of truth. Everyone that we talk to has a brilliant piece of advice that if you put it into practice, just not even in your act, but in your everyday life, like Mick Ayers talks about, you know, some of this advice is going to shrink years and years off of just being out in the real world and practicing this stuff. If you're aware of it through reading some of these interviews and some of the experiences of these guys, it can accelerate your learning curve dramatically.
Well, how did you decide which ones? There are 19 different people who you had talked with, and so I'm sure that you had a bucket list of people you wanted to talk to, and how did you kind of weed that out or come to the conclusion these are the people?
I originally wanted 30 magicians. I was like, you know, 30, that's a good round number. And it was an idea where at first Jason and I talked about this maybe three, four years ago, and I had shelved it. It was an idea that I had. And then one day I was out and about, and I went, you know, I'm going to do this. So I had messaged the amazing Jonathan because I saw that he was actually his wife. And, you know, we would chit-chat on Facebook, and I went, you know, I'm just – going to ask him, would you be a part of this? And he said yes. And so from there, I I started kind of creating a list of people that, when I was doing magic, people who I kind of looked up to, people who I really enjoyed watching, and I wanted it to be a different. Like, I wanted everyone to at least be different than the last person that I interviewed. So when I also reached out to Rudy Kobe when I went out to Vegas, and so I interviewed Amazing Jonathan and Rudy Kobe, and Amazing Jonathan was like, oh, would you like to interview Matt King, and gave Mac a call. So it was really a lot of times I would reach out to someone and they say that's a great idea, and they would usually offer me someone else that they thought would be a great fit to the book.
So one person kind of led to the next. That's great.
Exactly. Yeah, it kind of just snowballed.
It was a beautiful, beautiful application of word of mouth marketing. It truly was. Truly was.
It sounds like everybody really enjoyed the project enough that they could recommend their friends to talk with you about this as well.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone was really humble because, I mean, when we talk about like a magic community you're supposed to, so it's a community. We should all have each other's backs. I was really afraid, someone's going to say no, they're not going to like it, they're going to, say that it's a bad idea, but every time I would ask someone, they thought it was a brilliant concept, and they were nice enough. I mean, I interviewed Paul Romhaney up in Vancouver, Canada, and he was just flabbergasted that I flew all the way to Seattle, I rented a car, I drove up to Vancouver just to sit with him for 2 hours to do the interview, and his mind exploded that I traveled from Orlando, Florida, all the way up there just to sit down with them for a couple of hours.
Wow.
So, I mean, I think that was the big part that I was willing to go out there and meet them because I felt that I wanted to be able to – because even in the book, we structure it kind of like a play. So at the beginning, we give a little kind of a scene background, like I traveled from here and we're in an office. His, study is decorated with ventriloquism puppets and Chaplin posters everywhere. So we kind of set it up like a play almost, and it's very interesting.
So you decided to go that route rather than trying to do something on Skype like we're doing here today.
Well, yeah, the only person we did on – I mean, we had a few people. We had two on Skype, and the problem is one of them, we had that kind of that jumble, where the internet cuts in and out, and we lost a good amount of the interview for that. And I also got a virus on my computer, which killed a few interviews, so they didn't appear in the book.
That's not good.
But, yeah, the only person was Peter Samuelson because I really wanted to interview him. And every time he was in Orlando or I was in New York, it was always he was out of town or we were too busy. So I kind of folded and was like, yeah, let's do a Skype interview and then see how it goes. So he was the only person that we actually sat down on a computer to interview.
And it's a great extension, too, of what I think magicians are really trying to bring to the world, right, which is live experiences. Creating these really amazing experiences for people that aren't delivered digitally. We're in a really connected age right now where we're connected peer-to-peer with people. You know, I follow magicians all across the world on Instagram, and to be able to come in and sit down in person with these magicians was a really special thing, was a really amazing experience and just a natural extension of the experience that we want to try to create as magicians.
Yeah, there's no question about that. Whenever that I had gone to Las Vegas myself just a couple of months ago, and I had scheduled a dozen interviews while I was there, and I had so many people who were so very nice, and if something happened that one person couldn't make it or a last-minute change or whatever, that someone else had made a recommendation, just as you said there earlier, Josh, saying, hey, well, you need to talk to so-and-so, or let me give him a call and get you into the show tonight and go to talk with this guy or whatever. So, I think there was nothing like the one-on-one experience, which is what I best enjoy, and a lot of times, like again with the podcast, I would probably say 90%, maybe 85% of the interviews or the chats I have, I don't like to call them interviews, but the conversations I have are live. There are people who are in my home. Yeah. They're staying with me, lecturers who are coming through, or I'm at a magic convention, or that I've traveled someplace or happen to see this show or this person, and so it's a one-on-one. And so it's much more – the idea is that I would like for listeners to feel as if they're kind of like a fly on the wall, basically in the room with us as they are seeing us, watching us talk. And I think there's also something that you kind of get that excitement when you're one-on-one with a person live, sitting right across eyeball to eyeball, with them too,
Yeah. The conversations are more than dynamic. They're free-flowing. We didn't go in, and that was one of the things that initially we had gone in. We would create lists of questions and – we thought we were going to approach it very formulaic, and then realized that You know, there were a few interviews like John Eek and Josh, you remember Josh, where we were going through and literally, Scott, we were just having a natural conversation. And John, who's a brilliant, an absolutely brilliant performer, he works on cruise ships. I think he's a cruise director now or an entertainment director. He was I met John at Disney a few years and not few years ago, more than a few years ago now. But yeah, just free flowing and answering every single question naturally within the course of the conversation. So each interview, they do answer similar questions, but it's not in the same order or in the same way, or, you know, it's just free flowing. And I like that much better. I'm like you, Scott. I like the free flowing dynamic.
Yeah. And that was what I was going to ask as far as the flow of this book. It sounds like that it's not going to be a Q&A kind of a thing where that you're asking the same top 20 questions and you're getting their response. You know, that could be good in and of itself. And I have heard some interviews, like some podcasts like that. And I've actually got a series of DVD or CDs from way back when, where a guy was talking with mentalists from around the world, and he had the same questions, and it was interesting to hear their perspective. For an example, they would ask a question about a magic square, and some people say, I don't use it. Some people say, I love it. Some people open with it. Some close with it, and they're a different perspective on certain things. So there was that. So that's a different type of formula, certainly, but it sounds like that you kind of had a formula that you kind of quickly threw out the window and kind of had a general idea, hey, that we're going to let this flow.
Yeah, we had a because at the very beginning, I mean, even when you read the book and or listen to the interviews, it's you can tell how much better Jason and I get at the interviews, because at the very beginning with Amazing Jonathan, it was somewhat formulaic because I had never done it before. And as the interviews continue, I started to realize that it was the questions that we had written down, it was probably about 10 questions, is if they started to veer off topic too much, we could kind of veer them back in a little bit. I think probably in each interview, there's only about 3 questions that we ask over and over again. I know one of them was kind of, how do you got your start in magic? Are you a character? And if anything happened to you on stage?
Right. Yeah. And then, what was the one that I'm – oh, how you become a character or when you become your character.
Yeah.
When do you become – switch over from being you to – being who you are, as you present, like John Lovick becomes Handsome Jack, or Tina Fey when she becomes whichever character she's portraying on stage, what that moment is. It was always interesting listening to the different perspectives.
I think it's interesting to have a character. I should say important to have a character. I've spoken with Danny Archer and John Carney, both who say that by having another character, it helps to get another act booked, because they say, okay, well, we had you last year. Well, but you haven't had this guy. You know, I've got another character, somebody different. And so this way that you have another opportunity to sell to the same company sometimes, even though you can say, look, well, I've got a different magic show that I can do. Yeah, but you're still the same guy. No, I'm a different guy, different character, different person, basically, when you see. So I think that's another opportunity of a character that you can offer when you're performing then as well.
Yeah, Paul Romhaney talks about that because he, you know, he's famous for his chaplain acts that he would do, right, you know, on cruise lines, and but he also does stuff as Paul Romhaney, and he has a couple different characters, and sometimes he's like, I can do my chaplain act, and then I can do the same show afterward, and it's just me doing close-up magic, or I'm doing a murder mystery. So he's like, I offer 3 to 4 different acts so that whatever they want, I can offer it to them.
You know, when I talk with him on the podcast, he said that he also does that chaplain in mime as close-up. I said, really? So you walk around and don't say anything. And he said, yeah. I'm just doing performing, you know, close-up, which is interesting because they can actually take a mime act to table to table, or, you know, strolling in a cocktail situation. I never thought of that before. It was a different way of kind of
He talks about that. He told me that he got booked with a bunch of magicians, and he did his chaplain. He was going to do magic, and he's like, I didn't even do one trick. He's like, I'll let all those magicians entertain him, and he just walked around as chaplain, and people just loved it. So he actually didn't have to do one magic trick. He just walked around as chaplain.
Right.
Yeah, you can be magical without having to do quote unquote magic. Mm-hmm. You can create an experience for people that is magical, that they'll believe that you did magic for them, where they experienced magic and you never actually had to do anything. And I thought Paul had a great piece of advice be your own opening act and transforming from one character into another in front of your audience and being, you know, part of the show. So they're getting to see you transform right in front of them, be invested and be invested in both characters equally, you know?
Yeah.
But sort of revealing that transformation to them.
Yeah.
Really genius.
I remember seeing Beb Bergeron, for an example, as he had done his show, and then he would put on his Rebo the Clown makeup, you know, in a mirror on stage as he was talking. Similarly, that Tom Mullica as Red Skelton then would put on this clown face to be the you know, Clem Cadiddlehopper, you know, just kind of not Clem, I mean the clown that he was. And so it was something that that the audience could see the transformation, and then you were in that new character completely. I think that that is, is tremendous and strong.
I think Max Howard does that really well too.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
Now, I asked you earlier about some of the guys who, you know, who was the most inspiring thing. Well, in that regard, then, what was one of the more interesting stories or something that that you'd learned from people telling you, character development?
Oh, man.
That's a great question. I would say Rudy Kobe.
I thought Rudy's was a really fascinating.
Yeah, how he developed Lab Man, I think, kind of blew my mind with his comic books and the way that he would structure it. I mean, everyone was unbelievable. Him and Danny Sylvester, I think, have like the more extreme characters in the book out of everyone else. And Danny talking about him creating the Sylvester the Jester voice and, you know, his costume alone is just impressive. But those two, putting them together and just the imagination that how Rudy Kobe said that, you know, Lab Man came to him, you know, in a dream and he woke up and started writing it and he would start drawing comic books. And it was a big thing where he wanted to create this character that was, you know, influenced, that he wanted to show that influenced by like monsters and sci-fi and Star Wars. And it's just unbelievable.
And I thought what was interesting about Rudy's story was that because he had had such a clear vision and he'd been working to build that character of Lab Man for years and years and years and had these storyboards created and, like Josh said, the comic books and drawing out that story, when Rudy was approached to do a television special, he was able to execute on it. Do you remember how fast it was? Like, a month, maybe 2 months, something like that?
Yeah, not even. I think the minute that he was going to do his first special, they're like, we want to do a special. And I think I think it was a couple of weeks he came back with these drawings. He's like, I want this. And I think they put it together in 2 months because he had already had all these different drawings there.
He knew what the idea and the vision was already. And like what we were talking about before, Scott, with, you know, knowing where you want to go and knowing what it is that you want to create. And he had such a clear idea of that, that the moment that somebody said go, he was able to go.
Right.
Which is really beautiful. Yeah.
Well, you had to weed out a lot of stuff, I'm sure, in order to get down, because otherwise the book would be several volumes. And so how many pages approximately? I mean, you got like about 10, 12, 15 pages, 30 for each or what?
It all depends. I mean, some of our, like our interview with Mick Ayers, I think was 2 hours and 20 minutes. So to transcribe that, but you know, I had to go through and we kind of weed out conversation that doesn't really apply to the book. I mean, cause we always would go off on tangents and talk about nonsense. So we'd have to kind of clean that up. The book is 264 pages, but I would say each interview roughly can be from, some of them are about 9 pages to 15 to 20. I think one of them is 20. I think Paul and Mix are probably the longest.
Is it something that you could just extract and take and read a chapter? It's like, oh, that was satisfying. I mean, like a little book of short stories kind of a thing, or does it need to be looked at from the total perspective of the whole book and how they tie together?
No, not at all. Because each one is we call it, instead of chapters, they're scenes. So, I mean, you can read one interview and then set the book down. Like, one of the people who had purchased the book was telling me, he's like, I read one scene a night before I go to sleep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nothing where it's story driven. So, I mean, once the interview is over, you kind of can process that and then you can move on to the next one. But I mean, we put a bit of a storyline in it of us traveling. But yeah, it's not something you have to read in one sitting. You can sit down and kind of just slowly go through it.
Interesting.
You know, my favorite books, that I like are the types of books where, I usually only read a book linearly once. And then I read it non-linearly, meaning, you know, I'll start in the beginning, finish a book. And then the next time I pick it up, I just open to random places in the book, read a particular section, and get a piece of advice or to think about something, and then I can walk away from it and then go back to the book in a completely different section to a completely another person.
Sure.
So I like books like that, and I think we you know, we had the idea, like Josh said, it's kind of linear in the sense that there's a storyline of the travel, and we started in Las Vegas and moving that way through the book, but the book isn't linear in that sense.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, yeah, it'd be picked up and read kind of as a short story individually as well. Interesting. Well, as we start to kind of conclude and wrap this up then over here, where can people find the book?
So you can go to magicianprepares.com, but we are – and there's links on there for Amazon. It's paperback. $25 on Amazon, and we also have a Kindle version, but that would be the place to pick it up, would be Amazon and any of your local countries.
And are you going to be selling it through magic shops, I assume, as well? Or
it's available through our publisher if they wanted to purchase it. I know that a few traveling magicians, a few that we interview that keep in touch with me, may buy some bulk so they can sell them on their their lecture circuit. Okay. But at the moment, don't think I haven't seen any orders for as far as brick and mortar shops. But yeah. Online is you know, pretty good, and it's Amazon Prime, so you can get it pretty quick. So.
Right. Yeah, almost delivered in the same day sometimes.
Yeah.
Seems like, yeah. Exactly. Absolutely. Well, listen, thank you guys very much. Again, I wanted to speak with you because I knew it was something kind of that touched my heart from the standpoint of being essentially a podcast, except just in written word. And so it sounds interesting, and I'm anxious to get a copy and read it for myself over here. So. For those who are listening and want to order through Amazon, let me suggest also that you go through the magicwordpodcast.com, and there'll be a link over there where you can click to Amazon through our affiliate program. And so that just accesses Amazon, basically. So anything that is purchased through Amazon, it goes through our website. We will get a little love back from Amazon. So I encourage everybody to try to go through there, and it might get a penny or two back towards me for each purchase over there. So
that's awesome.
We all get a little something.
Well,
listen, as we wrap up also, I appreciate so much with your time over here that you have taken the year and a half or so to put that whole thing together, but also the hour and a half or whatever it's taken. It seemed like to put this together over here. And so let me conclude, since the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, as you well know, I always ask my people at the end of our chats what your word is or your philosophy of life. So, Joshua, let me start with you over here.
Ooh, my philosophy of life?
Yeah, what is
live it to the fullest.
Live it to, ooh, I like
and be that. Humble.
Okay. Well, now those are two different things, you know. Some people who are humble are not really living it to the fullest, or vice versa, you know. So they can contradict, but those are good words. How about you, Jay?
I would say there's three: love, trust yourself, and be honest.
I thought you were going to say love, eat, pray, or something. So. Which is
love,
the title of
trust,
book.
And honesty. Those are the three pillars to a successful life, I think.
Did you find that a lot of the people who you spoke to gave you their philosophy kind of over a period of time? I mean, over the time that you chatted with them, did you kind of feel like, okay, I can put words into your mouth. I know where you're coming from now. I kind of know what your philosophy is. I know your magic word without them saying it.
Yeah.
Did you feel that?
Yeah.
I kind of feel that as well whenever I chat with people. Before that I ask the question, I have a general idea of what it is they're going to be saying, so I'm not surprised necessarily. Mm-hmm. But I find that they always have, just as you guys gave me some good words there too, I think those are good words of advice for us to listen and live by as well. So let me just say again, thank you very much for being on the podcast. And so that was Joshua Sinkamp and also Jason Wethington. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Thank Scott. You. I really appreciate your time.
You're welcome. And for the Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out. Well, not only did that sound like an interesting book, but actually it was. I did digest a copy of this, and I do highly recommend the book. It is a nice... I sort of say a bathroom book, and I guess that wouldn't be a polite way of putting it, but what I mean by that is that they are short reads. Certainly that you can just digest. Boy, the bathroom humor just keeps on coming, doesn't it? You can read a chapter of a interview, that is, with one of these people in a very short amount of time, but the thing is, once that you're finished with that, you can easily go on to the next one because you're thinking, well, that's kind of interesting, and also the way that they end, they talk about, well, I'm getting ready to go to this next place, and you'll like whatever we're going to be doing. So it's kind of fun that way, too. So sometimes it's kind of hard to put down the book between the chapters. But again, as he suggests, that if you want to just read it, put it on your bedstand at night, read just a quick chapter or a quick interview after about 19 nights, after the 19 magicians are finished, then you would be finished with the book. I would recommend this. It's a nice read, a fun read. It's something that you can learn from as well. And certainly that if you don't agree with one person's philosophy, that you can go then to the next one. You might get something and more out of the next one. Much like these podcasts, I suspect there are some that you have as a favorite that is different from some of the others. You might have liked one better than the other, just like each of these chapters and each of the magicians who were interviewed in the book. Anyhow, enough of that. I think you'll enjoy it. You can order it. Again, I suggest that you go through the Magic Word Podcast to the Amazon affiliate page. You can click on the link, go to Amazon, where that you can order a copy of A Magician Prepares Act 1 Interviews. I think that you'll like it, and also a portion of your purchase will go back then to help support the Magic Word. Now, I want to also thank Jason and Joshua for donating 3 copies of their book, which are going to be given away as prizes. So, another reason for you to go to the magicwordpodcast.com website, where that you will see on the blog for this week, at least for this week only, because I'm going to, after the contest is over, I take the link down so no one will continue to enter the contest after the contest has ended. But basically, you go there, you fill in your name and address, your email address, that is, and then a randomly chosen name will be selected. Actually, 3 names will be selected, and I will contact each of those 3 people and get your physical address for a copy of this to go out. Now, if you reside in the U.S., the shipping is free. If you reside somewhere outside of the United States, then foreign shipping will be applied. But before we charge you for that foreign shipping, I'll tell you what it's going to be, and then I will send you an email. You can decide whether or not you wish to pay for that. And if not, then we'll just draw the next person's name. So my point being is this is open to any and everybody, regardless where you reside. We have had winners of the contest in the past who have lived in Sweden and in Spain and in England, and they have elected to pay for the shipping, because actually when you stop and think about getting a free book, the shipping is not much compared to the value of the book or the prize you're going to be getting. So I want to also thank both Joshua and Jason, who have agreed to pay for the domestic shipping. And so I would also ask that if you are interested in helping the Magic Word Podcast, because we do have other contests that we will pay for the domestic shipping out of our own budget, that comes from the Friends of the Magic Word. And you can join the Friends of the Magic Word, again, by going to the podcast website, and you can find out information there about how that you can join the friends and help support us with your financial effort. So I think we've had a pretty good podcast, and it's getting close to the end of this, and so I think it's time for me to wrap up and say that until next week, stay well, get booked, and live life to the fullest, but remember to be humble. You should love, trust yourself, and be honest. This is Scotty out.